Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast this week. I'm John Montgomery. Well, April is a busy time here at FX Guide and also over at our sister training site, fxphd.com. We've got a new term being announced on April 1st, and we're totally excited. We've got a fantastic lineup of new courses coming out, so be sure to check that out on the 1st or after. And then, of course, in April, we've got the NAB conference over in Las Vegas, of which Mike, Jeff, and myself will be heading out there. We'll be having multiple FX Guy TV episodes, some FX podcasts, Red Center, as well as actually some stuff on the show floor on Tuesday at the event. So if you're NAB, be sure to come by and say hi. Now, already news about NAB is trickling out. Of course, After Effects and the CS5 suite from Adobe has been pre-announced. And then today we also had a new article that came out on FX Guide announcing Mari, which is a new product for the Foundry that was developed by the R&D and texture departments at Weta Digital. I had the good fortune to actually check this out several weeks ago before the Foundry Masterclass in London. And I've got to say, it's not only a very slick-looking product, certainly doesn't look like it's some kind of in-house tool, but it's also incredibly responsive and can really deal with some high-res imagery. Really a nice 3D paint texture tool. So be sure to read more about that in the online article at FX Guide, and we'll be having interviews on FX Guide TV in the coming weeks that dive into the product more. Now, our podcast today is actually going to focus on some of the work that Bruno Nicoletti has been doing at the Foundry, basically working on an underlying architecture that will take the Foundry tools and really easily convert them into both GPU and CPU-optimized tools. Now, the Foundry is going to be coming out with two new plugins with After Effects, taking advantage of CS5 64-bit as well as GPU processing. It's Kronos 5.0, which includes retiming and motion blur, as well as a camera tracker. Now, what's interesting about the new Kronos offering is it sees incredible speed up by utilizing GPU acceleration in CUDA-enabled graphics cards. As you'll hear in the podcast, they're talking about up to 4 times faster processing, which can actually be incredibly significant. It's actually interesting that they're actually not running into bottlenecks based upon the stuff they're running for the GPUs, but simple I/O functions, reading images off disk through the application and then writing them out again. So they actually have a significant amount of headroom to actually make the processing faster. So I think it's really some interesting bit of technology. And so let's go ahead and join that conversation. Mike Seymour speaking with Bruno Nicoletti. And they'll dive into some, you know, actually quite fun and geeky details about some of the new tech coming out of London.
And Bruno, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So we're really keen to follow up on the work that your group has been doing inside the Foundry. Of course, the Foundry has got many fronts, but the sort of, I think you've nicknamed it the HPC or high performance computing part of the Foundry seems particularly interesting. Tell me, what is it that that involves and how long has that group been going?
Well, the group's a fairly small group of two people at the moment. We've been going for just under a year now, and what we've been involved in doing is reformulating the way we write image processing algorithms. So we basically come up with a brand new image processing framework which can exploit GPUs and CPUs. It's still something slightly early days at the moment, but we've finally managed to get a few of our core algorithms implemented in our new framework and running on CPUs and GPUs and getting some nice performance out of the things. So that's been an entertaining little ride for the last year or so.
So I guess in many respects when we're talking about this area of research, it really falls into two categories. There's algorithmic work that might be, and I'm going to use the example of optical flow because I know it's one of the areas you've been working on. There are the algorithms of optical flow, and I'd be keen to discuss some of those with you. And then, of course, there's the implementation of whether that's done on CPU or GPU and also how parallelizable the algorithms are. So one obviously affects the other. Have you been looking at both sides of the equation then, like, or just speeding up the existing algorithms?
What we've really done is concentrated on writing our new image processing framework, which can exploit GPUs and CPUs seamlessly. Our proof of concept is rewriting Kronos, effectively our image processing engine, our optical flow engine, inside our new framework so it can run on GPUs and CPUs. So we've been kind of crossing the boundary, but our use case was Kronos. But the core thing our team's been coming up with is this new image processing framework, which can... The neat thing about our framework is you write your algorithm once in effectively straightforward C++, and our framework takes that, spits out optimized GPU code, and at some point in the future will spit out optimized CPU code as well. So you can basically write your code once and it'll run anywhere. And to prove that our framework actually works, we took one of the most difficult bits of code we've got in the company, which is Kronos, and wrote it in that framework. And said, okay, translate this to GPU, translate this to CPU, and it works. And that's what we've been kind of fiddling with for the last year. So it's not so much the algorithmic research from Kronos, it's the technical research to make us be able to write Kronos easily and exploit any compute device. That's really what the HPC team has been doing for the last year. And it works.
Well, to get the increases in performance that... one hopes to obtain by going to all this effort. Presumably, it comes down to whether or not you can parallelize the algorithms, because it's not just a matter of getting faster CPUs, it's getting more of them actively working and in a sensible fashion. How parallelizable are the basic Kronos optical flow algorithms?
Fairly, actually, because it's kind of hybrid block-based, pixel-based algorithm. You can, it parallelizes quite well, so you can throw effectively, it depends on, parallelizing for GPU and parallelizing for CPU is actually quite different, which is one of the reasons we came up with our framework. And we hide some of that parallelization detail from you, so long as you express, understand how the fact that the algorithm is parallelizable, you can take it apart, break it up a little bit, and throw it as many compute devices as you have, it works quite well.
So there are basically three optical flow algorithms, if I remember my university maths, is kind of which was actually your university maths as well, as we were at the same university. So there's
same year.
Yes. So there's being facetious there, because a lot of this stuff has been developed since we were at university together. Yep. But there's block matching, there's frequency-based, frequency-domain-based correlation stuff, the kind of phase-based correlation stuff, and then there's gradient-based that Michael Black, I think, pretty much pioneered. Am I right in thinking that your stuff is pretty much block matching?
It's kind of it's a hybrid kind of block gradient-based thing. A lot of it's based on the work of Anil Cochran from Dublin, and we've kind of taken that and polished it to a high degree. But it's basically it's a hybrid gradient block-based thing where you try and match blocks by walking down gradients, if that makes sense, trying to minimize errors in blocks by following a gradient in the image. And because you've got lots of blocks, you can parallelize on the blocks. So on something like a massively parallel GPU, you throw a block at each. Effectively, GPUs have lots of cores at them, many, 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 many cores. We're running many thousands of threads, and you basically assign a thread or a block, a thread to a block, which gets thrown on a core, and parallelizes quite well. So our algorithm basically starts off with a block, tries to walk it down a gradient to match, to find the nearest equivalent gradient, and does some other local area smoothing to make sure that other blocks more or less agree with it around it. Once we've done the block matching, we then throw it to pixels. So we then try and do the equivalent for pixels to get quite fine detail per vector, or per pixel vector at that point. So we do blocks, refine the blocks, smooth the blocks, then throw it at pixels. Each of those levels of refinement can be done effectively on an individual core.
So if I was to use the analogy of my hand moving up, and I wanted to change the speed of my hand moving, performance. So you're going to segment various motion regions. In other words, you're going to identify that this region of the frame where my hand is seems to be moving as one kind of region of the similar motion. You're going to determine by those gradients and edges the sort of corresponding regions between across frames, effectively, as well as lines, and then you're going to link, of course, the frames to kind of have a reference point upon which to move from. But isn't there a last stage where you're basically looking at generating intensity and alpha maps? Because as you change that, you're going to have to sort of effectively fill in missing information.
Yes, that's one of the key problems. Not so much motion estimation, but the using motion estimation vectors to create a new image. You've got problems where you have my hand's moving across the scene and there's nothing behind my hand. You can't see behind my hand, and it's trying to guess what goes behind there.
Yes.
And they're called all kind of horrible heuristics, effectively. And that's where most motion estimation engines motion estimation based retiming falls down. And ours does it, everybody's does it, you get this kind of cracking and breakups around the edge. So typically what you want to do to get around that is isolate it in some way, either rotoscoping or trying to pull a key or something, isolate foreground from background and effectively do a separate retime for foreground and background. And our code manages that process.
Yeah, I always joke that that's the chicken and the egg problem. If you can just tell it what's the chicken and what's the egg, it finds it a lot easier to do stuff with it. But notwithstanding that, if you don't provide a mat, the program still has to solve the problem. I'm wondering if that last stage is parallelizable at all.
Oh, yeah, that's part of the picture building stage. And that's very parallelizable. And that's actually much cheaper to do than, say, the motion estimation in the first place. So that all comes up. For example, on an NVIDIA 5800 GPU, we can do that in about 7 milliseconds, which translates into, I can't remember, 150 frames a second or something. We could, in theory, peak performance, do a picture build on. So that whole pushing vectors, pushing pixels, is highly parallelizable as well. In fact, the whole thing is fairly parallelizable.
Okay, so if we imagine that you've been awfully clever and been able to parallelize the algorithms for GPU and CPU, and that these algorithms obviously are not trivial but are doable, the other thing that we really want you guys to do is provide us with consistency, that if I move between different places that I'm rendering, that I don't get radically different results. And this must produce an extra dimension of difficulty, like if it wasn't hard enough already.
The way we got around that is because we're not directly coding to each device. We're not having one programmer write the CPU version and another programmer write the GPU version. We're writing one version of the algorithm, and our magic code translation that our framework does creates identical code on different devices.
So you're producing a level of abstraction from the hardware, as it were, even though, because that's the thing that, you know, we've always lived in fear of. So if you go for a hardware solution, then you're locked into that hardware and you don't get the benefit of the next hardware upgrade unless you redo everything.
That's one of the strong reasons we came out for doing this new framework, was we didn't want to be locked into the hardware. The next time somebody comes up, we haven't done it quite yet with the framework, but we're going to be targeting, say, SSE instructions on the CPU, the next generation of SSE instructions. You don't want some poor bugger to go into the motion estimation engine and go, okay, you've got SSE 16 coming out now. What do I have to do to make it go faster? I've got to delete this, put an if. Oh, God, it's complicated. We want to avoid that completely. So what we've done is you write straightforward image processing abstractions, straightforward C++ to do your thing. And we take that, understand it with some magic, and generate heavily optimal CPU and GPU code saying, okay, now use SSE 16 or 55 or whatever the next generation is going to be, or use OpenCL or CUDA, or use CUDA or OpenCL extensions to make it go faster on the GPU. So we really forced ourselves to isolate you from the device as much as possible. There's a few tweaks here and there, but on the whole, it's device independent.
So I've, loved your stuff for forever, but then I'm a geek. So somebody who's less geeky than me and just doesn't give a rat's about CUDA, and I do, but somebody is like, what does this mean for me? So you've done this speed up to the Kronos engine. So how does that actually translate into an initial product? Where's the first point someone's actually going to see that appear in a point that it can actually make a creative difference to their workflow?
First place you're going to see this is in After Effects. As a plugin to After Effects, we're going to release a Kronos and a motion blur plugin, a retimer and a motion blur plugin, branded as Kronos. And that's the first time you'll see it. You'll actually exploit, it'll run on the CPU without it. If you run it on a rack mounted machine in the background, it'll run quite happily on the CPU. But to exploit it properly, you'll need a CUDA-enabled GPU to use a GPU, because that's what we've targeted initially, because CUDA is a very mature, stable programming framework for general purpose GPU programming.
So in the most basic kind of product benefit kind of senses, if I was a guy shooting on, I don't know, a 5D Mark II and I hadn't got the upgrade of the software, and I wanted to retime my stuff from 30 frames a second to 24, or I shot it before I got the Canon firmware, I would go to After Effects and I'd be able to use your tools, and that this would run on the GPU, what, about how many times faster?
For example, on for an SD footage, we can, on a decent GPU, we can do about 18 frames a second. Doing that on a CPU, we're probably pulling about 4 frames a second.
Right. So you're actually talking about
end-to-end using in After Effects. That's After Effects calling. It's the whole overhead of going through After Effects as well.
So in for me as the user that only cares about the creative, I could literally see a 4 times plus improvement in that problem of having to reprocess footage because I wanted to move from a different time base, obviously a substantial difference.
Yep, so you're having to wait a lot less. There's limits to how fast we could make this go. In theory, we could run on a decent top-flight GPU doing SD footage. If you want to do a 2-to-1 slowdown, say, we can probably process that at about 60 frames a second. So we know the timings. We can actually do it at 60 frames a second, but there's a slight overhead in feeding the data to us. So it depends on how fast. What's limiting us now is the bottleneck is the application. So it's as fast as After Effects or whatever else we move it to next can feed us the data is slowing us down.
Which is good news because, you know, presumably over time they will get faster and you're there to kind of take advantage of it when it comes.
The overhead now is not so much the computation, it's actually getting the data off disk, you know, to us to process to get back to you to write back to files on disk.
Okay.
Which time it becomes practically free now, if that makes sense, compared to the rest of the effects pipeline.
So this is great news. And of course the other caveats with optical flow still exist because we haven't fundamentally change that. So if I've got very noisy or grainy footage, it's going to work less well so it goes.
It's pretty much exactly the same Kronos algorithm we've rewritten in our new framework. We rewritten it from the ground up in our new framework, but it, you know, we sat down with the research guys and said, okay, tell us how the hell this damn thing works, and just put it apart, put it back together again. It's some subtle differences here and there, but it's pretty much the same algorithm. So we made no claims in having improved the quality of that. We just made claims in improving the speed of it. What we hope to do next is we've got some ideas, having gone through, we've had some ideas on how it probably could be improved, and we want to throw it back to the researchers and say, okay, we've got this great new Pro framework. It's actually much easier to write image processing software in on the whole as well, so it's actually quicker to get turn stuff around. So hopefully we'll throw it back to them eventually once we release this properly internally and say, okay, researchers, go make it better. It should be easy to make better as well. Go make some better, nicer, faster Kronoses for us.
Yeah, and it doesn't stop there, right? Because the theory is that because you've built this level of abstraction and because you've built this engine, this blink that we're, you know, calling this technology, now has the opportunity to be applied to other things. So, for example, and I'm not trying to commit you to anything, but if you decided to swing your attention to some kind of stereo workflow problem, this idea of going for a GPU solution should be something that would extend into anything else that is, A, something you want to do, and B, something that parallelizes.
Yeah. I think that's exactly the whole point of the technology. Kronos was the, you know, proof that the damn thing works. And then we want to push it further out to the company into other products, into more plugins, hopefully embedding it in applications as well. This is just the very first cut of the technology.
And you picked a darn hard one to start with. I mean, you didn't give yourself an easy one out of the gate, did you?
because you can do a color correct on the GPU. It's fairly easy to do it already in stuff like GLSL. And we knew that was going to be a trivial case to do and pointless to speed up because that's not where the hard bits are. And so we thought, okay, let's pick the hardest thing we could find, and it was Kronos. given that, say, some of the stereo tools we have in Ocular are based on similar, not exactly the same technology, but very similar technology to the motion estimation engine, it shouldn't be too hard to throw a lot of the Ocular stereo tools at Blink and make that GPU easy as well. So well, I'm not promising any products at any point in time, but that's for instance we could do.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that you guys have known for a class of image processing problems, and I've often said, like, you know, you don't even necessarily get me 100% all the way there when I'm working with it, but you get me the 85% that I otherwise couldn't bloody do no matter how hard I tried, and I'll just sit there polishing, getting the last, you know, 5 or 10%. But that is still a huge, huge plus. But let me ask you this, just changing gears slightly. Tell me about Jay, because he worked on this extensively.
Oh,
right?
Jay, Jay Cornwell is one of our success stories as an employee. We hired him originally from Imperial College during a summer placement they had for undergraduates. And we took him on, and we threw some, God, I think it was our licensing code, we threw some evil little problem at him, and he solved it quite well. We liked him, and he came back again to do his full-on, they do industrial placements where they actually get sent out for 6 months to live with a company. And so he lived with us for 6 months. We threw some harder problems at him, and he coped with those quite well. So he went on to do a PhD at Imperial College again. We sponsored his PhD, and a lot of it focused around this co-translation stuff I've been talking about. In fact, I've got his PhD right in front of me, which hasn't been quite submitted yet. So he went and did his PhD at Imperial on exactly this stuff, and he finished his PhD at the beginning of last year, about April-ish, and came to work with us, and we threw him straight onto this. So it's been basically Jay and I working on this, you know, getting it together and putting it together and making it work, and it's been a success.
It must be great it's for you great. To have another whole generation of computer scientists or image processing guys come through like that, from intern to PhD to...
It's nice to have somebody, you know, see that continuity from sort of spotty youth to seasoned programmer in front of you.
I imagine so. And tell me, in terms of the work that the Foundry is doing, how is the culture now of your R&D section? Because obviously you've grown since we spoke last on the record. You've had a couple of major acquisitions and a few other expansions.
I think we've hired another three people in the last 7 days, some extra docs people, for example, some extra developers. The expansion's entertaining. The office is getting quite squeezy, but we're growing quite well. It's a fairly rational expansion, you know, our various plans, and it's going well. It's quite exciting, actually.
And I guess what's also interesting for a number of us is that this announcement comes in the wake of you having moved some of the the original plugins that you developed over to GenArts in a deal there. So clearly you are still developing plugin technology, albeit more centered around perhaps more serious industrial level image processing than some of those earlier tools.
Yes. That was kind of a hard decision to pass our Tinder, our motion graphics-y kind of eye candy tools over to GenArts, you know, for me personally, because I wrote a big chunk of them. But it was a sensible decision for us to make, because we couldn't give them the love they deserved. And our future we see is very much concentrating on these high-value, hard problem-solving things. And we're still committed to developing plugins, but, as you say, much more concentrating on solving hard problems.
So, yeah. So let me look down the track for a second. I'm going to ask you for an opinion now that is absolutely not fishing for an official position from the Foundry, but I would like your general opinion on this area, because clearly what you've done is you've managed to parallelize some core algorithms and really take advantage of the GPUs. In the area of render farms, which is not directly related to what you're doing, of course, but in the broader scheme of things is very relevant to the industry right now, do you see a day that we'll move to primarily GPU render farms, or is that just a ridiculous dream and that really we're always going to end up with these massive, you know, thousands of CPU render farms and GPUs just at the desktop?
No, I do see that. It's something that's already started. Some of the big West Coast houses, Disney and ILM, I do believe, already have effectively mini GPU render farms for some of their own custom things they've written. For example, there was a Flame, I'm trying to remember from Seagraph last year, I believe it was Iron, wrote a Flame simulator that ran on GPUs, and they got a little tiny render farm together for that, and people putting more and more effort into doing GPU-style programming because of initiatives like CUDA and OpenCL. So I actually do see GPUs penetrating more and more into the render farm. They won't replace it completely. There's stuff you can't do in a GPU. There's rendering, ray tracing and rendering, all sorts of that stuff, 3D rendering. You can't do on a GPU as well as you can on a CPU at the moment, and potentially may never do. So there's space for both. But I do see GPUs being thought into render farms more and more, simply because the performance advantage you can gain for the things can be quite amazing. But it depends on the workload you throw at the things. So the CPU render farm won't go away. You'll just see GPUs being thrown in there as well.
So again, not looking at specifically to do with the foundry, but just generally speaking, one of the things that makes this whole project viable for the industry is the reliability, if you like, the consistency that we're seeing from things like Qt in terms of NVIDIA's efforts to make this a very much more standardized workflow that you can rely on rather than things breaking every 6 months. You must have seen quite a development in stability in the GPU stuff over the last few years.
Yes, we have. CUDA, which came out about 3-4 years ago, initially as CUDA 1, of course, was entertaining. It was, you know, it was kudos to NVIDIA because they did the whole general purpose computing on a GPU thing, and they did some hard problem solving to get that going. The drivers initially had issues, as all drivers do, but they really, really settled down. I've never, apart from when I've done something really stupid, had a bug in our code, we've not managed to bring down, for example, on Mac or Linux. I think we have on Windows once. The machine, so they've been rock solid under the CUDA 3 beta we've been playing with. So I've been really happy with that, with the performance of CUDA, and to some extent it's much easier to program. It's going to be much more stable than, say, an OpenGL or DirectX driver will be, because there's a huge layer of complexity in DirectX and OpenGL, which you don't have inside CUDA. It's a much simpler framework to develop for, it's a much simpler framework to implement. So that in its own very nature will make it more stable over time. Where we do want to take our code eventually is probably to OpenCL, which is a more industry-wide standard for doing the equivalent of CUDA. At the moment, the drivers from various manufacturers are slightly, they're not there yet. We're seeing performance differences. We're seeing issues here and there, some actually mainly performance issues. So what would this
do? Do you mean performance issues in terms of like computational performance, or performance issues in terms of output differences?
Computational performance. The outputs are pretty much the same. We're just seeing the equivalent thing running the CUDA as opposed to OpenCL run a bit slower than it should.
Right.
So we've decided to go for the more mature API at the moment, which is CUDA, and it's very, very stable. CUDA is just, from what we've played, that it's been stonkingly stable. We've not really managed to bring a machine down, apart from when we've had stupid bugs in our own code. So CUDA is what we're aiming for at the moment. But long term, we do see OpenCL as being the future. There's technical benefits to OpenCL, but at the moment, there's performance issues that aren't there.
But the other thing about OpenCL is presumably OpenCL lets you, you know, communicate with a wide variety of different manufacturers' GPUs, whereas
yes,
CUDA is, of course, NVIDIA.
Yeah, because as you say, OpenCL is an open, as they say, ATI, or sorry, AMD now, NVIDIA support it, Intel, in theory, on board. So we're quite keen to actually pursue OpenCL as our framework of choice, but it's just early days with that technology at the moment. There's any reason we haven't chased it up.
And other things like SSE?
SSE, yeah. With our SSE is going to, you know, there's AVX, I do believe, is the next generation of SSE instructions they're talking about shipping out, which will probably be in CPUs come the end of this year. Given our framework, we aim to target the code translation stuff we do to SSE and to the next generation stuff as well, so we can exploit those quite readily and easily. We just haven't got, we've been so busy trying to get our stuff just proof of concept working on a GPU. We haven't chased that pathway yet, but we will.
Well, look, as I say, in the specific, of course, people are really enthusiastic to get their hands on anything that's going to run 4 or 5 times faster for doing high-quality retiming in After Effects. Mm-hmm. And, of course, at the more broader level as an industry, I think it's terrific that you've adopted such a good kind of robust base for doing this mm-hmm. idea of this underlying Blink technology, so that you can apply it to different things into different areas. And that hopefully means we'll see a bunch of stuff moving that way over time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for speaking to me, mate.
Well, I found that to be a really fascinating discussion. I like, number one, hearing about the creative benefits and actually the time benefits from a standpoint of being an artist, knowing that it's going to make my life easier by having stuff process faster. I also really like diving into the details and finding out kind of what's happening under the hood and why it's working the way it is and why it's faster. I actually think that helps us tremendously as artists, maybe not day-to-day, but just in general in getting our jobs done. As I mentioned in the opening of the podcast, coming out next week, the first week in April, we're going to be having an FX Guy TV app that's going to focus on the new Mari release from the Foundry, so be sure to check back for that. And then NAB will be covering the event on FX Guy, as well as actually through Twitter. If you want to follow us, mine, Twitter name is JohnMontFX. Mike Seymour's is Mike Seymour, one word, and Jeff Huser's is Neon Marg. Well, that's it for this week. As always, for my partners Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.